You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello everyone, welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and it is the 30th of November, 2022. I want to remind everybody about my merchandise page my wife put together. Everything is available from Radio Albion. Of course, the Patreon and direct donation, the box that says support the Orthodox Medievalist. And of course, buying my books on Amazon or at the Barnes Review. There's some at Romata Press, which is a part of Lulu, or uses Lulu as a printer. They're all over the place. And I appreciate people who have gone out of their way to support me in every way, including leaving reviews on Amazon about my books. So, thank you, everyone. And please, I require these kind of things to be able to function. Speaking of Patreon, I'm going to be publishing an article that you should be familiar with. I did three shows a long time ago on the political theory of Montenegro. The Montenegrin idea, in other words. And I'm going to upload it's about a 25-page, single-space paper that can serve as the core of a book on Orthodox Montenegro and what happened even into the 20th century. I would like to get some feedback on that, either through Skype or my Telegram page, whatever, if that's in fact something that I can do. Of course, at the same time, I'm working on my book on China and a lot of the fake right-wing acts of terror that the left has invented over the years, including the My Lai massacre in Vietnam, among many other things. But we're not going to deal with that today so much. We're going to deal with something else that's interested me for a very long time, and that is the abuse of psychiatry in the Soviet Union. Or let's put it like this, the use of psychiatry in the Soviet Union. I see the good in that field. I've seen it help people. But more vividly, I see the evil in this field. It's inherently political. It's not medical, in the sense that there isn't a baseline of normality that isn't social. People are normal or abnormal, given the dominant paradigms in society. Of course, the ultimate problem is outside of things like, you know, chemical problems in the brain. And the brain can malfunction like any other organ. But even that's not necessarily the realm of psychiatry. It deals with behavior, not objective processes. And it's being used. The Swiss doctor who questions a vaccine has been declared insane. The former king of Belgium, when he refused to sign the pro-abortion bill, was declared insane, and then declared sane as soon as the bill was passed. It's a politicized field. And the Soviet Union took it to new heights and used it as a mechanism to squash dissent. My prediction is that, as this is already starting, this is going to become more systematic in American life as time goes on. They're going to deal with dissidents as the Soviets did, by declaring them schizophrenic. And I'm telling you this, when the new DSM comes out, it's going to have a political... You already have antisocial personality disorder. Again, these are all this is social science. These aren't, you know, it's not like there's a schizophrenia tumor that you could biopsy. It all has to do with behavior. So there isn't an objective foundation to it, which is its biggest problem. And you could redefine antisocial. I mean, we're against the current organization of society, so therefore we're antisocial. There's a million ways you can do it, but I'm predicting there's going to be other more explicitly political diseases that they're going to invent. Homosexuality, for example, of course, it's a mental illness, but that was removed, I believe, in the 70s, because that movement became very powerful and captured the imagination of the ruling class, and now, of course, is a big part of the ruling class. There was no breakthrough study or anything. So it's politicized. So that's how the Soviet Union dealt with dissent on a mass basis. And it's going to be at least one prong or one pillar in enforcing this great reset in America and Western Europe. It would be called something like ideological distortion syndrome or there is already kind of a defiant syndrome. They could rewrite these to apply to us. And because Americans generally believe what people, you know, what established authorities tell them, especially in the medical field, as we know now for an absolute fact, not a whole lot of people are going to question this. Now, the psychiatric establishment, highly centralized, was based on Pavlov. In fact, who was as pro-Soviet as you can get? There was a day dedicated to him. I have Lenin's order. It was 1925 or 24, and then he became not just the celebrated leader of that field, but it was enforced. And anyone who criticized him was removed. And you could see how the materialism, the cause and effect, basic conditioning ideology, connected with, you know, Darwinism, which is one of the reasons that Pavlov ever became a physician in the first place, or anatomist, really. And, of course, the whole theory, it is very well known with him, came from studying the digestive tract of dogs, and that then becomes generalized to human beings, is quite consistent with, you know, materialism. Of course, the basic structure of this was the fact that the USSR had solved the problem of history and solved the problem of alienated labor. Therefore, mental illnesses should have been ebbing away. Mental illness, in Pavlov's point of view, is that some stimulus overexcites somebody. You know, this. The notion of excitation and inhibition is the core ideas of his behaviorist idea, in a very simple and crude way. It's when, you know, the imbalance of your nervous system comes when minor things, or even non-existent things, provoke an extreme excitable reaction. Or, of course, the very opposite. Something that should be important doesn't affect you at all. And it became a very effective way. I've hinted at this before in my speech on Grigorenko, General Grigorenko, who wrote quite a bit once he was exiled to the U.S. because he was drugged up too. But I want to cite two people in addition to Pavlov. The first person is Professor Yakut, who wrote in 1965, What is Dialectical Materialism? And one of the chapters was Matter and Consciousness. And to put it simply, I mean, even early Marx spoke of what consciousness was. And the simple truth is that, according to Yakut and many others, labor created both man and human society. That it's through labor, through any productive activity with a social purpose, that the brain, which is the foundation of consciousness, developed. So even Marx will say that consciousness is a social product. And so long as humanity exists, it will remain that way. It's a product of man's life and society. So if you have the capitalist form of alienated labor, you're going to have all kinds of imbalances mental illnesses and what they call ideology or the belief, the false consciousness, the belief in official ideology comes from this alienation. Something's off balance. Consciousness comes from the human being acting on nature. But acting on nature is the very definition of labor. Of course, it's strictly nominalist. All these people have to be. So the abstractions that we take from comparing things and categorizing things for our own purposes is just, it's imaginary, but it's still part of how consciousness developed. Engels even wrote an essay, the part played by labor in the transition from ape to man. And even things like, you know, standing erect came from the use of tools. Man's forelimbs, you know, as he would say, were then free to operate and then perfected. I'm not sure which one came first with him, which is a constant problem of Darwin, but it shows you just how important Darwin was. And it isn't so much that the employment of natural implements, you know, basic tools. We see this with apes, but that's not labor in the true sense, as he would say. It's undergone development. The first artificial implements of labor is the beginning, or is the start of labor and the height of consciousness in that early stage. Didn't necessarily mean human society, but and throughout all of this, speech also developed. So the unity of language and thought based on the social arrangement of labor is the heart and soul of how the Soviets viewed consciousness, how they viewed alienation. Language and thought, of course, are not identical. But thought reflects reality in a very objective way. So while a diseased society, an alienated capitalist society, is going to create a lot of imbalance and mental illness, which has a social root, so a socialist state will do the opposite. So you see how very easy it is to go from the sickness that's not supposed to exist, then or a reaction or an ideology that's not supposed to exist in socialist society, then means that this person is sick biologically. The other person, I think he's more, I think most of you have heard of him, Lev Vygotsky, in a chapter called The Socialist Alteration of Man. Lev Vygotsky, of course, is far more influential than Kant was. But he also quotes Engels. He wrote in 1930, the other one was in the 60s, that psychology, if you're going to study psychology comprehensively as a science, Karl Marx says you're going to have to learn to read the history book of material industry. And that's important because, as he says, it embodies the essential powers of man and is an embodiment of what of psyche itself. The Marxist idea, accepted by the USSR entirely, is that man has infinite potential. But capitalism does the exact opposite. It reduces the potential in each individual person. That man is able, through industry, to control his very, develop and control his own nature. But the capitalist division of labor, Vygotsky, they all pretty much said the same thing, does the opposite. It distorts it. That socialism is typified not so much by equality, which was not an important variable there, but it's the ability that every single person has, in a very non-scientific way, to master his environment, to produce his own freedom through industry. Which is another way of saying that the development of economic relationships is the same thing as the development of the social order. If you have a society that's dedicated to maximizing the individual control over his surroundings, which, of course, the Soviet Union claimed they were doing, the potential is limitless. But capitalism, on the other hand, through the division of labor, creates retards. Because, and even Adam Smith mentioned this, in his pin factory idea, that division of labor means that some person is doing one very simple, repetitive part of a productive process over and over again, 8, 10, 12 hours a day. What does that create? Yes, it creates the foundation for liberation in the Marxist sense, but but only when he fully controls, collectively, the means of production. Therefore, he could finally find out what human nature is, and in fact, in the process of doing that, create it. Liberation from the fetters that curb human development is exactly what the Soviet Union pretended to be about. You know, Marx talked about the eventual breakdown, the difference between town and country, the difference between mental and physical labor. This is all going to be one thing once consciousness was free. The Soviet Union was deep into doing this, according to, you know, the system at the time. And therefore, anyone who is doing the opposite, there's something wrong with him. There's a Pavlovian excitation over things that either don't exist or are very minor. So Vygotsky concludes, among other things, by saying that education, which he never defines, at least not in this book, education then plays the central role in this transformation, the social formation of generations to come. But education, of course, is something that the state, the Soviets said, was the working class, and that confusion and conflation is the heart of Soviet ideology. Because they have figured out the key to history, which is the connection between productive relations on the one hand and social development and personal development on the other. So this was the basic foundation of how the Soviets viewed consciousness and psychology. Karl Marx didn't spend a lot of time on the question. Lenin really didn't either, because everything was done in collective terms. And of course, you know, Pavlov was just as influential in the U.S. as he was in the Soviet Union. He was the official psychologist of the Soviet Union, but he became extremely dominant in the U.S. too, and eventually was granted the Nobel Prize. And, you know, he really was Pavlov was a piece of garbage, because when you read about his experiments on dogs, he did a lot of nasty things to them. He attached things to them. He attached things to their intestines, all when they were still alive, measuring different things. He had no, you know, he was a sociopath. He had no compunction about doing awful things in the process of trying to observe their digestive system relative to various forms of conditioning. And the very fact that he took that connection and projected it onto human beings through Darwin shows you really the nature of this dumbing down, this belief that essentially all matter is one thing, and consciousness is just the key to eventually dominating the nature around you, which has strong roots in the Kabbalah and the occult tradition too, fixing the world to tikkun olam. Now, legally speaking, the criminal code in the USSR was continuously updated. And the first one was 1926, and there was an alteration in 1960 after the death of Stalin. Now, while the Soviets always used psychology and psychiatry to destroy dissidents, it didn't become a mass institutional phenomenon until the 1960s. Stalin had other more blunt uses of to control people. Only later, only after the death of Stalin, and even around the fall of Khrushchev in 64, the Soviets, in the detente era, had to find more, quote-unquote, humane ways of dealing with dissidents. I can't imagine how the American psychological establishment is not going to start using this. It's something that most people won't question. It's an alternative to prison. Once you're labeled a schizophrenic or bipolar or whatever, people don't have to listen to you anymore, which is one of the great advantages of this. And after a while, especially with the medication that they were using, and the medication that exists now, eventually you could get these people to say that I am sick, which in the Soviet Union is how they got out, and making a public recantation. But 40 articles, more than 40 articles, the criminal code that in the 60s were ways to control dissidents, and the local codes were very similar. And it's Article 70 of the criminal code, which is called anti-Soviet agitation and propaganda. Article 64, I think this is pretty well known, was entitled the treason to the Soviet Union, so-called motherland. And that includes things like, you know, flights abroad and refusal to return. And those who tried to immigrate abroad had this problem. Who would want to leave? Why would you want to leave? There's something wrong with you. You go from a non-alienated society to an alienated society. There's something else. Of course, other than mental illness, the other thing is that they're simply working for a Western intelligence service. And a lot of this was dishonest for on a lot of levels. But the fact that the U.S. was trading heavily with the USSR, was invested heavily in the USSR, and was a direct, you know, these drugs that they used all came from the U.S. or Great Britain, which was, again, traded freely. This, remember, was the wave of the future for many intellectuals in the 20s, 30s, and 40s, and especially in the 50s, because of the victory during World War II, which largely was an American financing the USSR, opening a second front, despite the fact that the Soviets did most of the fighting. But then there's Article 72, which is based on organizations, organized what basically we would call terrorism. And it would have to be an anti-Soviet organization. And so that was their version of a RICO law, where membership in an organization was enough once that organization is identified. And beyond all this, legality as words on a page didn't motivate the Soviet system at all. Now, 6 years later, in 1966, there was a executive decree in Russia as a part of the USSR. And there were three new articles. First was Article 190, which really was the big one. And 190.1 is condemning the dissemination of deliberately false fabrications, discrediting the Soviet state and social system. So anything anti-Soviet was by definition a false fabrication. 190.2 was any desecration of the state emblems or the flag. And 190.3 was, as I mentioned, the organization. An organization that acts against the public order. Now, of course, the big one is deliberately false fabrications. This is said thousands of times a day in the U.S., everything from social media to the state itself, that anything that liberals don't like is inherently false. The mentality is exactly the same. The foundation is exactly the same. The intellectuals who created it are exactly the same. This is one of many points on which the U.S. and the USSR are identical. Solzhenitsyn started that list. Now, of course, there's hundreds of more items to add to it. And with the use of mental illness as a way to silence people, I mean, it's even in part of popular culture. They, you know, if someone doesn't understand someone else, you call them crazy. Or if someone says something that is out of the ordinary, or something you don't know anything about, they're off their rocker. They're bipolar. They're schizophrenic. And I've warned people how dangerous that is. First of all, it's not an argument. And second of all, that you're equating dissent with mental illness. And they're usually dumb enough not to realize what I'm talking about. Of course, there was reactions against this. And part of the reaction was people claiming, like, under the former president of the Russian Federation, Poropenko, Anatoly Poropenko, who actually wrote quite a bit on this, who was opposed to this idea. And the argument basically was the conflation of political crimes with mental illness is completely dishonest. But there's certainly nothing in Marx, and God knows nothing in Lenin or Trotsky, that would militate against that. And even things like systematic vagrancy. You know, begging was illegal, according to Article 209. Hooliganism, being a parasite, participating in illegal trade, whatever it is. And the point was to avoid public outcry, which in the 60s and 70s, as the Soviet economy ground to a halt, and so many elites had, you know, went to Israel, which was a whole battle in the American Congress to the only time they ever put sanctions on the Soviet Union was when the Soviets kept Jews from going to Israel, in the so-called Jackson-Vanik Amendment that punished the Soviets for doing this. And it was only when the system began to depreciate wildly in the late 60s and 70s that suddenly it became almost fashionable to condemn this, despite the fact that there's been no system, no capitalist or socialist system that didn't use this. It is inherently political. So if you're able to say, well, this person is sick, he's not an enemy, he's done bad things, but he's not being punished, he's being treated. Well, Westerners, especially Western journalists, were dumb enough to go along. They generally just repeated whatever the Soviets said without much criticism anyway. But there were all kinds of regulations about this. And there was a, things like instruction for urgent hospitalization of the mentally ill, representing a public danger, which came out in 1961. And that gave legality, as many have stated before, to non-legal imprisonment. Because it wasn't just a matter of being isolated in an institution. It also meant that you were, whatever rights you had as a citizen of the Soviet Union were gone. So forced medication and things like that were, there wasn't a problem there. And given their control over the press, no different than in the U.S., they say these people are ill. So there was no legal grounds for any of these. They wouldn't call them an arrest. Oh, this poor soul is sick. So the instructions for emergency hospitalization could condemn someone in a psychiatric hospital for a very long time. And a very long time is determined by the staff there at the time, largely in Moscow. Now, they invented a lot of mental illnesses, but that's no different than the American system. And one of them, the most notorious, is the concept of sluggish schizophrenia. A.V. Snezhnevsky, who was the leader of the so-called Moscow School, and who was the chief, he wasn't anything special, but because he was a conformist, he created the sluggish schizophrenia idea. He became the head of the institute in Moscow. But even those like Nikolai Pushkovsky was condemned, who was a psychiatrist, who was condemned by the same system. It was a, a way to bridge the gap between illness and prison. Simon Guzman, who of course is a Jew, opposed it in the 1960s. And Americans, eventually, American Psychiatric Association condemned the Soviet system. As if they weren't doing the same thing. Snezhnevsky became the absolute dictator of psychology and psychology in the USSR. And any alternative diagnosis wasn't just rejected, but it was persecuted. Sluggish schizophrenia, it's hard to get a solid definition of it because it means that you have schizophrenia, you just have no symptoms yet. You have things that maybe, at some point, will lead to symptoms. There was no real diagnostic criteria, a total lack of diagnostic standards, and really no solid classification because there were no symptoms. So the point was to be able to fit dissident personality types into the framework of this disease. And when you have full centralized control over what counts as psychiatry and psychology, that's not difficult to do. Again, you have the same centralized system based on one ideology. In the U.S., it's gone further than the Soviets. They condemned homosexuality as this perversion, tranny, all that stuff was non-existent. I'm telling you, these people would have ended up in the gulag if they tried to do this stuff in the USSR. Especially, again, as the economy began to slow and the Brezhnev stagnation. And, in fact, it reached its height in the early 70s precisely at this time. And at no point did anyone reconsider this legally in the USSR. Even Walter Reich, condemned it. You know, the ideology didn't, or even religion didn't have anything to do with the condemnation. If anything, it would meant that psychiatry will be associated with this kind of repression. Bloch, Redaway, Morozov, D.R. Luntz. These were people who were given jobs and money and vacation homes and cars because they accepted this ideology. It's no different than if you were to go into academia. I don't care what field you're in. If you're not a leftist, you're not gonna remain. The extra step here is saying, well, you know, I mean, the left thinks they've solved all questions. They've solved all issues, which is one of their justifications for censorship. Just like the Soviets said, we solved the riddle of history. Well, the American Empire says the same thing. And since there's only one answer to a question, anyone who says otherwise, you might as well say 2 + 2 = 5, especially given the fact that these people in journalism or academia have no idea what we say. They're sheltered from everything. You can't even get information, normal channels, especially in university, about us. So it makes it very easy to caricature, to invent a whole straw man stereotype, and then, given this straw man, say how sick these people are. So Shnevnevsky, as the core doctor, so-called, of the Moscow school, and dominated the... it's like Lysenko in biology, around the same time, completely reinterpreted the idea of a mental disorder and therefore made it possible to conceive of a dissent, an ideological or religious dissent, as a symptom of a severe mental disorder. I've also talked about the Romanian camps that use these similar psychological techniques, only to an extreme, to control dissenters. That schizophrenia was so massively overdiagnosed in the USSR, especially in the 50s and 60s. And there was the so-called Leningrad School of Psychiatry that was eventually removed and banned. But sluggish schizophrenia has no real connection to our definition of the term schizophrenia. And that there was no connection. The Soviet school, Shnevnevsky and everyone connected to him, starting from the 50s, were forcibly cut off from the Western schools of psychiatry and psychology. To a great extent, I even question the big distinction between those two fields. One can prescribe medication, the other one can't, but they use the same language. So sluggish schizophrenia, which, as I've predicted, is making a comeback. You're seeing this, and I could quote people in that field who are talking about, well, he might not have a disease now, but listen to what he's saying. And the more they're isolated from us, the more that the bubble that they live in is sanitized and censored, the easier it's going to be to say these people are crazy, because I've never heard this before. I guarantee you there's a rare academic out there that's heard our point of view in anything stated in a rational and scholarly way. They've never come across it. They wouldn't even know where to go to find it. So another word for this was low-grade schizophrenia. So according to the, and this is a quote here, in accordance with the special instructions of the Ministry of Health of the USSR, patients with schizophrenia need urgent hospitalization, which due to the eccentricities of the clinical picture, think of delusions, hallucinations, whatever, they coined the, well, I didn't coin the term, but it's a much, I'm not quoting anymore, heboid and geboid states. That's a much older term. Heboid states mean a disease without symptoms. And a geboid state is the opposite. But a heboid state, you know, of course we see this in COVID, the fact that they could declare someone a schizophrenic without symptoms, it shows you just how far they were willing to go. And I'm telling you, it's already happening here. Not systematically yet, but that's going to change real soon. And any kind of, you know, social or political initiative the Soviet system didn't like, it was called the manifestation of delirium, or the term, the phrase was, a geboid state with antisocial behavior. And that automatically, according to the law, led to involuntary hospitalization. The Soviet psychiatrists were very interested in the paranoid development of the personality. This is one of the varieties of a what they call the pathological development. And they assumed that there was some kind of trauma, like warfare, visiting the West, friends and family that lived abroad were responsible, at least in part, for paranoid reactions. And one of the phrases in Russian, it comes out to be a litigious paranoid personality, but it's a sort of mental illness that makes a fetish out of law. In other words, if you're too strict in the letter of the law, you have a litigious personality. People like Glusman and Bukowski noted that personality development turned out to be a convenient diagnosis for psychiatric repression of dissidents. And this is, I'm quoting here again, certain manifestations of nonconformist thinking and behavior, for example, the dissatisfaction with the release of a person from his position after signing a protest statement by him, a judgment about the occupation of Czechoslovakia or the absence of democratic freedoms in the USSR, could easily be diagnosed as the nonsense of litigiousness, or a fetishization of the law, or the same nonsense of reformism within the framework of the paranoid development of the personality. Now, the nonsense of legality and the nonsense of reformism is a direct translation. The idea that the Soviet system can be reformed from outside the party is also a sign of mental illness. A dissident doesn't live in reality. His life is subjective, not objective. In the beginning, I quoted some of these guys that talk about how important an objective approach to nature is, but the problem is, who decides what's objective in this economic and political realm? Well, the only person who has the right to do that is the person who has solved the big questions of psychology and history. And that was Marx and Engels and Lenin. And what these guys ended up saying, you know, Glusman, Bukowski, a whole bunch of others who were dissidents despite being trained there, even the concept of the struggle for truth and justice, the statement of that outside of the Soviet system, were found, according to them, among individuals of a paranoid structure. Statements that court hearings, you know, by persons with that paranoid state, this is where their ideology comes from. They even, Kurotenko, and this comes from Snezhensky, the phrase truth fanatics, people outside the Soviet system who were convinced of the correctness of their views, was one of the big symptoms of the paranoid personality. How many times a day do you hear that, oh, you're paranoid, having, of course, no clue of what that might mean? The literal Greek translation of paranoia is something in excess of reason. It's another word for delusion. Rather than you altering your point of view to reflect the power around you, you insist that the power around you change to reflect you. That's the literal definition of paranoia. And as absurd as that sounds, that's exactly how it was stated there to justify their forcible hospitalization. And these hospitals, I don't need to explain, were not exactly places where people got healed. Now, people who actually committed real criminal acts, you know, theft, whatever, if they were accused of having a mental illness because of that, which may even be true in some cases, that didn't get them out of prison or anything else. I think it's something like the Institute of Forensic Psychology said 95.6% of offenders who were diagnosed with anything the paranoid type were recognized as sane. However, if you were accused of an ideological crime, it was a different story. It almost always led to a so-called diagnosis of some kind of insanity or delusion. So dissidents diagnosed with this sluggish schizophrenia nonsense were almost always recognized as insane, despite the fact that there really are no diagnostic criteria here. Of course, the big issue was the successful adaptation to society, which is the exact same phraseology used by psychology in the U.S. And given how deeply ideological psychology and psychiatry are, that's not going to change. It is being used, but not systematically, to shut people like you and me down. The fact that this develops both at a time of great economic stagnation on the one hand and the era of détente on the other is important. It's really hard to claim that we should be taken seriously by the West and you shouldn't make war on us. They can't start shooting people if the West is watching very closely. So this was a way to get around this. De-Stalinization didn't mean that the camps were dismantled. That never happened. It didn't happen until the early 90s. It just meant that the criteria for condemning someone changed. It became medical rather than legal. You think of how convenient that is. That gets around all law and words on a page and procedure, even a claim to justice. This is a biological problem, therefore it's beyond a legal remedy. Now, even in the age, Pavlov died in the 30s, but he was influential in the West before then. Of course, he functioned in the imperial era. Now, Freud, despite what the Frankfurt School is a combination of Freud and Marx. That was their whole thing, and it was very Jewish. I mean, I don't think there were really any non-Jews in the major names in the Frankfurt School. But Freud initially was rejected by the USSR. In the first years of the Bolshevik Revolution, you did have Freudians, and an early Frankfurt idea occurred in the 20s and 30s. But by the mid-30s, Freudianism was gone. It was called pseudoscientific and reactionary, in all senses of the term. And, of course, pure censorship with anyone, especially someone like Jung, any of the neo-Freudians, were condemned. Part of the reason why is that, let me quote Fedotov, who wrote the official article on Freud in 1958. He said this, basically false and speculative, it ignores the role of ideology, the physiological mechanism of disease, and denies the deterministic significance of the external society, precisely because of the assertion of the primacy of instincts over conscious action and the limiting of the role of social factors in determining human conduct. Freudianism constitutes a weapon of bourgeois reaction. The center of contemporary Freudianism is the USA, which, as is well known, is also the center of world imperialism. That was the official condemnation of Freud in the USSR, starting in the 30s, but didn't become big until the 50s. And if you didn't adhere to that, you were dismissed. But there's several reasons for this. Why were the Soviets so hard on Freud, especially since, in a limited way, he is able to you can connect him with Marxism? But the first reason is these kind of irrational, egotistical instincts in the subconscious are intolerable for the Leninist society. No, it's social factors and economics that determine behavior, none of these instincts. And in fact, really, instincts are just social forms that have been turned into habits. They're not really real. And the second reason, though, is the ultimate solution in Freud's sense, the adopting an independent and autonomous personality, which, of course, is the very opposite of everything that the Soviets preach. But it's also everything that American liberalism preaches, too. There's no autonomy, and there certainly is no diversity. There is conformism. So, for the older Soviet, the definition of a cured person is the successful reintegration into the social whole and the adoption of the responsibilities that go along with Soviet citizenship. And, of course, the collective is far more important than the individual in the Soviet system. Now, it used to be the opposite in the West, but it no longer is. The acceptance, the reintegration as a regime is generally correct. And opposition to it is terrorism. That kind of reintegration is central to what psychology very now and very soon systematically is going to define as the mentally healthy, healthy man. But Pavlov in general wasn't just for psychology and psychiatry. All medicine came from his point of view, just like Lysenko in genetics. And everybody else was purged. It's funny, the anti-Pavlovian psychiatrists who were followers of Freud were Jews, overwhelmingly, and they were demoted from their positions. Now, Sosnovsky was Jewish, of course. Most of the Moscow school was. But so were Freudians. Early on, you had a debate between Freud and Pavlov, but it was decided by force of the state that Pavlov is correct. And Sosnovsky was the leader of the Pavlovian school in the 1950s. And it was the Institute of Psychiatry in Moscow, which was the sole recognized central institution of that field in the entire USSR. And those in Leningrad and Kiev who fought them were purged. And despite the fact that later on, de-Stalinization led to a slight loosening of those restrictions, Pavlov was still a condition for employment. So, again, the big question, as I've already mentioned, is the idea of sluggish schizophrenia, because this was attached to most dissidents. And I'm hearing this, maybe not using the same terms, but I'm hearing this in psychology today, especially when it comes to kids. The onset of this is so hard to detect, insidious, as they say, barely discernible, that only professional psychologists can see it, which is a key issue. If you recall, in 2020, when they were trying to defund the police, they said that psychiatry and psychology is going to take their place. I guess you're going to send doctors out to stop gang violence by talking to them, or maybe even medicating them if the gang is inconvenient. They're given, and how they can testify in court as expert witnesses, and in some cases without even interviewing the person in question, shows their incredible legal power. And because only they can see the beginning of schizophrenia, schizophrenia was just a catch-all term back then. They have authority where the ordinary person doesn't, because the person with sluggish schizophrenia seems to function perfectly well in society. And so it comes down to these, the enemy of the people can be the person who works next to you. He could be perfectly normal in all respects, but he could be a serial killer. It's the same idea. And of course, people are encouraged to tell on their coworkers. So while they could behave normally in terms of practice, it isn't in theory. Professor Luntz is one of the big names in this field, that schizophrenia can be theoretically present in somebody, not necessarily actually present. And so from the 60s and 70s, especially from the early 60s, the concept of mental illness was broadened to the point where they could make anything out of it. But it's really no different today, where, all you do is that you take someone's self-reported behavior and see which set of symptoms it most closely matches. It's not exactly a scientific matter. It's a subjective matter, which is why it's so dangerous. And the fact that they are capable, then and now, of taking control of somebody. It's more difficult to involuntarily hospitalize someone today. And it's not nearly as centralized as it was in the USSR, although that's also changing. The state, from the mid-60s, from the fall of Khrushchev in 64, there was a clear policy of using psychiatry to finish what the state itself, in terms of its police powers, was unable to do. They could do what the state didn't really want to be known for doing. They couldn't do the kangaroo courts like they used to in the era of detente. any threat to the system ideologically. This is why insanity became so powerful. Again, as I said, they can go around any legality. Even if they don't interpret it properly, it's very easy to explain this to others. But even people like Sidney Bourque, who I've been quoting from for at least a little bit, he had a trial in this respect, and he was interned in a mental hospital despite being, you know, a supporter of the system. The dissenter now is as he said, you're surrounded by really disturbed people, given drugs, and drugs for their side effects, not for their therapeutic purpose. And really the only way out was to recant. And it was, you know, a way to deal with communists who, while members of the party, rejected how this system was working. But even when they're released, you are still placed on a socially dangerous list, which keeps you under a psychiatrist in the same sense that an American would be under a probation officer. It became a deterrent. There was a disease that they invented called the National Holiday Syndrome and Nixonitis, which were invented mental illnesses over time were used to condemn people. I mean, mental hospitals were temporary prisons. So the way Bloch and many others say, there's really only two ways to get out of this. You have to say, this really occurred at the invasion of Czechoslovakia in 68. It became central. You have to say that you were wrong. This is no different than a celebrity that makes the apologies for saying something that's not leftist. You know, the Michael Richards and all of this. And they have to say, these views are part of my diseased mind, a product of my diseased mind. And these were errors that I came to in a state of delirium or something like that. But after a while, you did have some Western protests. You had leftists and socialists in the U.S. and Western Europe who didn't like this idea. This isn't the foundation for dissent. It isn't the purpose of psychiatry, although some of us may disagree with that. Westerners began to campaign for this to end. Leftists in the West, especially in the Frankfurt School, which developed around this time, that connected Freud and Marx, didn't think that they were in opposition too much. There was a work called Crazy Psychiatry. As I mentioned, Anatoly Poropenko in 2002. This is only in Russian, as far as I know, and most of my sources here, with a few exceptions, are in the Russian language. The central argument was to condemn the system. Someone who committed a crime in a state of illness or even a temporary disorder of mental activity were, of course, declared insane. But the same thing goes for someone who committed a crime in a state of sanity, but had an ideological tinge to it, got the very same treatment. And if you wanted to extend someone's stay in prison, you could say that this person developed a mental illness while in prison and keep them there. I'm not sure how this was different from gulags. I guess people were saying things like this to get out of the gulag, but I don't think the mental institution, which are always overcrowded, and actually had really mentally ill people in it sometimes, they at least wanted to get out of the gulag, and so they started talking about how insane they were. But the same thing happens in the West, when these official apologies, which no one, by the way, ever accepts. The left will never accept an apology. So it's a ridiculous approach to social life. It never works. Michael Richards never came back, and he didn't really do anything. And you notice how they never quote what these people say. They just say it's some rant. They never reprint it. So there's a concept of the difference between a legal idea and a verbal idea. The verbal idea is something that is the subjective interpretation of the law by the psychiatric profession. It isn't legal. It's not supposed to be legal. And even for those who, you're a sane person who's a dissident, you get sent to a lunatic asylum, you're there for a few years, And as I said, you either can be released with a, you know, psychiatric probation officer who has full control over him, or you end up going to a gulag anyway. And that secondary form of treatment, not a whole lot of people survive it. And even if you're, you know, on trial for something, the judge can say with psychiatric assistance that in the process of these proceedings, this person has gone insane from the stress, and therefore we're going to put him in an institution. So you don't even have to go through the legal procedures. And of course, this put a huge strain on the system. You didn't have enough people for this. So the difference between sane and insane disappeared. It was strictly ideological, no different than in the U.S. And there is an explanation. You had a lot of people who went along with this, not just because it was the only way to be professional, but even people who suffered from this system. And one of the reasons is that when the same person is put in an asylum, this is a very bad situation. There's even there was a Soviet term for it. They called it induced psychosis. If healthy people are kept in solitary confinement or just constantly around real psychotic people, they will then become paranoid in their own mentality, at least from the outside. They'll see that way. And then, of course, they were given two drugs that were, of course, developed in the West, Haldol metoclopramide, I think, which is a barbiturate. It's a benzo. And these also, because it was very crude at the time, caused the creation of insanity in otherwise healthy people. So you had people who were sane when they were condemned come out and they're not sane anymore. And these drugs were in their very crude form. They're not really prescribed anymore. But right up until the end of the Soviet system, this is what was used to shut people's higher order thoughts from developing at all. The zombification. So, but the legal context continued to change, and it got more and more detailed as time went on, but it didn't mean that psychiatrists weren't given full carte blanche. I mean, so long as they're trained in the right place and the Communist Party accepts their practice, they were all state employees, as it was everybody. So everyone who was arrested for these kind of crimes was given a forced psychiatric examination through an appointed, a court-appointed psychiatrist. And that person decided what they were. And this was the legitimacy for shutting down entire groups of people. And you had a huge number of people, including leftist Jews, army generals, from every walk of life. If they had a problem with some aspect of the system, it was so much easier just to say that they were insane. And even in the post-Khrushchev period, this got even worse. Anyway, there are several others who had another explanation for the systematic use of psychiatry to control dissidents. And it comes from a group of people, Rudnyenko, Danilov, of course, the head of the KGB, Andropov, who became dictator in the post-Brezhnev world, and Shilokov. They had a tough time with the gulag, of course, being a big part of the economy, but a very inefficient part of the economy. You had a massive increase of those diagnosed with these illnesses in this period of time as the economy came to a near standstill. And this kept increasing at a time where they were claiming, especially in the Brezhnev era, that we have reached developed socialism. It is socialist now. But rather than dealing with this question, they simply built, the mid-70s, a huge number of new psychiatric institutions. People knew at all levels of the state that this either passive or active dissidence against the regime never stopped. And the repressions were pretty consistent in different areas. But Andropov, who of course was an admirer of Dzerzhinsky, wanted to change the basic outlook here. that they were to, quote-unquote, civilize the reprisals against dissidents. So they would replace the unprofitable gulag system with a psychiatric gulag. And you had, by even in the late 60s, you had a whole secretariat dedicated to this. That the Planning Commission was going to increase purchases of both drugs and building of institutions massively. And people like Suslov were very much in favor of this. And but construction became very difficult in this period of time. You didn't have enough beds for people. So they ended up being placed in the worst possible condition. Really, the number of beds in the psychiatric hospitals in the Ministry of Internal Affairs was something like 4,425 in this period of time. But that's just official beds, not, you know, people being sent to gulags and everything else for the very same reason. This is a, and at any time, you know, any attack from the West was called a, you know, a slander campaign against the USSR. It didn't mean that pharmaceutical companies weren't selling them drugs. They were. It didn't mean that the West was helping them build these things. They were. So a lot of this is pure rhetoric. But the point of it all, ultimately, as I'm running out of time here, is the very same ideology, the very same system, the very same rhetoric used to break down dissidents mentally and physically in the 60s and 70s is being used right now. It's a lot of the same people. It's the same ideology, the same language. And this is what happens. You know, the Soviet bureaucrat was totally insulated from any alternative point of view from the outside. I think it's even worse for Americans. They have no idea what we think. So how easy is it to make us into monsters, terrorists? They're doing things like redefining the word violence, redefining the word terrorism, trying to conflate a scholarly opinion with verbal violence, whatever that might be. And they all have the one thing in common. On both sides, it's very vague language. Even a cured individual, what does that mean from the point of view of psychology? And the simple fact that in all these cases, there is no factual basis for holding that someone who is concerned with truth, truth fanatics, as they were called in the Soviet Union, of course, were ill in any way. They may have become ill in the process of their treatment, which just gave them more reason to keep them institutionalized. And that's going to happen now. This is kind of like when you react vehemently to someone's abuse, they could turn around and say, oh, look at this lunatic. And that's exactly what they did there, and that's what they're going to do here. Psychology, starting, you know, when they first started talking about this systematically in 2020, it's going to increase in power. And the definition of mental illnesses, which no one really knows anything about, are going to be recast either more specifically to include people like us or more vaguely so they can include people like us without really having to think about it, as a way to control dissidents. There is a single monolithic regime that controls the Western world. And we are on the outside of it. It's so much easier to call someone schizophrenic, give them drugs that actually make them schizophrenic, than going through any kind of legal wrangling. This is why they were going to kill Gaddafi, kill Saddam Hussein, because unlike people like Milosevic in Yugoslavia, they didn't want these people talking. They didn't want these people to have their testimony recorded, because we know what they're going to say, and they're going to be right. So killing them made a lot more sense. It just made life easy. And that's what's going to happen to us as far as the psychiatric system is concerned. Thank you, everyone, for listening, and I will talk to you next time. Bye-bye.